This panel is source of funds, issues with China, other EB-FI investor markets, and third-party exchanges. Our panelists are Anu Nair, Classical Immigration Law Group, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Jaina Aristizabal, Markham LLP, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. June Chang, Fredrickson and Byron, PA, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Thank you.
So hi, everyone. We're going to be talking about source of funds. And as you see from your outline, we're going to be focusing on specific countries. So we kind of did a mini informal poll, and it looks like we have a nice mix of people where we have kind of people in the EB-5 industry who've been doing this for quite some time. We have some who have, you know, a good handle on what EB-5 is, and they process maybe a handful of cases per year. And we also seem to have some newcomers, whether that be immigration attorneys who are just starting to do EB-5, and I know we have a handful of potential investors in the audience as well. So we're going to try to give a little bit of background in everything we're talking about to kind of hit all three audiences. So one of the first things is regarding source of funds. You'll see we're going to be talking a lot about China, which from the earlier panels may not make sense to a lot of people because, you know, the China market has slowed down a little. But there are thousands of Chinese investors with 526 petitions pending. Those who have done EB-5 and have been in the EB-5 industry for quite some time, you'll know that the regulations, the law really doesn't provide too much guidance on how to put together a source of funds document or source of funds packet. So a lot of times USCIS is making policy on RFEs, on cases that are already pending. So that's why we're going to be talking about, you know, the changes in RFEs, what we're seeing for these specific investors, because, again, that's how USCIS tends to make new policy for source of funds. So the first, I'm going to turn to June to take us through a really hot topic at the moment, which is the third-party intermediaries. So June, can you give us a little bit of background by what I mean by third-party intermediaries, what USCIS was previously doing, and what the new adjudication trends have been?
Yeah, thank you, Anu. And thank you, IUSA and AILA, for having us here. Before we jump into the topic, I just want to give you a little background of our practice. I practice immigration law at Fredrickson & Byron. We are a full-service law firm based in Minneapolis with offices across the Midwest region, an office in Shanghai and another office in Monterrey, Mexico. With our Shanghai office set up, that's a little over 10 years ago, we started to see increasing interest from Chinese clients who wanted to take advantage of the EB-5 program. And over the years, we have seen the similar trend as the rest of the industry. We had a lot of Chinese investors probably in the first 5 to 7 years, and now that interest is starting to go down, while investors or clients from India, Vietnam, and a sprinkle of other countries have shown their interest and have participated in the program. The source of fund issues that we have handled over the years, some are country specific, and others seems to apply across the board. And like Anu said, a lot of the source of fund issues we're dealing with are moving target, and what we are doing that works today may or may not work in a couple of months or in a couple of years down the road. So our group really has been taking a pretty conservative approach when we put together source of fund reports, meaning we really try to document everything. And we try to build up our case with as much objective evidence as possible and fill in the gap with, you know, personal statements and company letters, subjective documents, documentation. And we try not to take risks based on the information and the rules that we know of as at the time of filing. And we really try to be transparent with our clients, explaining clearly to them that this is only what works today, and it's possible that USCIS might come back in a couple of years asking for more documentation. So a little more background on the source of fund. When we prepare the I-526 petitions, the investors bear the burden to, one, document that the source of their investment capital is lawfully earned, is lawful, and two, trace the invested fund all the way back step by step to the source that we stated the fund is from. So third-party value exchange issue comes up in those countries where the government imposes a restriction on the amount of foreign capital or the amount that each individual can exchange and transfer out of their home country in a given year. So we see a lot of this with Chinese investors, the Vietnamese, and I believe other countries too. Take Vietnam as an example, because that, I think, is what we have been dealing with most recently. Because of the restriction on individuals exchanging foreign currency and transferring them out of Vietnam, when investors' capital is in Vietnam, meaning they have to somehow find a way to get $550,000 or whatever the administrative fee is of U.S. dollars and get that to the project of their selection. But we also have to be able to trace the U.S. dollar amount back to the investors as a documented source, right? So when you have a gap between the money that's in country that's trapped and the U.S. dollars that's being put towards the investment, we have to be really careful to document all the entire transfer process. And I should say, before we dive into what has worked and what's being asked for now, that I'm not an expert in foreign currency restrictions, and by no means are we telling people how to circumvent foreign laws or regulations. And in fact, every time we have a client who's coming from one of these countries, we tell them to make sure you consult with local experts on what the restrictions are and make sure that whatever you do is in compliance of your local laws and regulations. So in Vietnam, a very common way of for investors to get their money out of Vietnam is using services provided by these companies that that does currency exchange and money transfer. So typically, these are companies that have international operations. They have branches within Vietnam and bank accounts, of course, within Vietnam, and also branch offices outside of the country where they have available foreign currencies, particularly U.S. dollars, in their foreign bank account. And what investors, what we have seen investors do is that they give the investment capital that we have already sourced in Vietnamese currency to the third-party company. We carefully document that transfer or that transfer, and then the third party's overseas company take the equivalent of U.S. dollars based on the currency exchange rate at the time and transfer that amount to the project's escrow account or the project's designated bank account. The documentations that we typically would gather to trace this entire transaction include investors' withdrawal of Vietnamese currency, the investor's statement, or either it's a bank transaction record, or if they give cash to the third party, then we carefully document their withdrawal and a statement from the investor confirming that they gave the cash to the third party, and you have a receipt from the third party confirming receipt of the specific amount of Vietnamese currency, the exchange rate that was used, the date that the currency was exchanged, And we also make sure that there's language in there confirming that investors' funds are now, you know, now along the line of the funds have always been the personal property of the investor, and the third party never assert any ownership over the funds used. And then you document the bank wire transfer from the third party's overseas bank account to the project's escrow account or the bank account of the project. And oftentimes we now see that the regional centers also require a document basically signed by the investor designating the third party to transfer such funds in their under their direction. In our experience, we have not needed to provide source of fund documentations for the third party that provides this currency exchange and transfer service, but I definitely have heard of people who have been asked for that in recent years.
Yeah, definitely. So I would say prior to 2016, if you were a Vietnamese or a Chinese investor, because a lot of our Chinese investors do the same thing, you did not have to document the third-party intermediary source of funds. So as June mentioned, you just showed that transaction within China or within Vietnam and the foreign transaction for U.S. dollars. Around 2016, the government started coming back and asking the Chinese investors. It was late 2016 we started seeing the first RFEs saying, hey, how did this third-party intermediary now have all of these U.S. dollars? Show me where that money came from. And for whatever reason, it was very inconsistent adjudication, as I'm sure we're all used to seeing. I was getting approvals simultaneously with RFEs where they used the same exact path of funds. I would say it's only, I got my first Vietnamese RFE on this topic about a week ago. So Chinese investors have been dealing with this for about a year and a half. Vietnamese investors, the trend I'm just starting to see right now. I don't know if you guys are seeing the same in your practice.
I agree. And I think just from a practitioner's perspective, it's probably prudent to at least do some due diligence on the third party that's being used by the investor to make sure that should that documentation be required or requested by the USCIS, you have things to back it up.
That's exactly right. Sorry.
Well, I was going to just back what Jin was saying is that it is important. Documentation is important. As much documentation when you do your original source of funds that you can provide up front, with the idea that anything may be questioned later on at a point in time, which it's 2 years after the filing. So as much information as you can provide and trace and prepare as part of your funds in your report, that's what you want to do to the filing.
Right. So, you know, one of the, I think this is something that we've been talking about for quite some time. You do have to find a balance of what you want to provide, what the investor wants to provide, without kind of moving that target line for USCIS. My concern is USCIS is going to continue to see just massive amounts of documents and then expect that from every single investor. So even right now, if I have a single intermediary case, I'll advise the investor, how do you want to proceed? Do you want me to file all of the documentation you have for your third-party intermediary, or do you want to go ahead and file as is? We have it ready to go if there's an RFE, and we can deal with it at the RFE stage. I would say 95% of the time, the investors will come back and say, I have it ready, go ahead and file it. I'm hoping that they don't, because my concern is now we're legitimizing USCIS in their, what I consider to be an absolutely ridiculous RFE. So kind of take that into consideration, and we'll talk a little bit more about the RFEs and, you know, if it's going to be an immediate denial or not.
Just to talk about the RFEs and the timing, what we've seen also is over the past 8-9 years, just that what you would receive in an RFE 8 years ago is not the same that you would receive in an RFE now. The details and the tracing and the time frame that they're asking for is getting longer and longer. Where you could do a report and trace back a history of maybe 5 years, 8 years ago, or even 7 years, four years ago, I'm having an RFE where they may go back 10, 15 years for a capital, for a business that's been in business that long. for a capital contribution of something that's insignificant. So what we're seeing, and that's the guidance on how we prepare reports, is based on what we see through some of these RFEs and talking with colleagues as far as what they're seeing. And as we met together, we're all seeing the same push from USCIS on these RFEs to just give more and more detail. So as we prepare reports, we're preparing it that with that idea. We want this to go through. We want it to get accepted immediately. So we go to our clients and start tracing back as far as they possibly can and reasonably can provide and with that documentation.
And another, go ahead. Oh, no, I was just going to mention that I had a case, it's been about a year and a half at this point, where they came back and asked me for my investor source of funds, which was an accumulation of income that she'd earned from a company that was first established by her grandfather after World War II. And the government came back and said, how did the grandfather have the money to establish the company after World War II? And we went back and we just said, this is the most ridiculous RFE I've ever seen in my life. Can you please have a supervisor review this RFE? And then we provided, of course, affidavits from the parent to say, hey, my dad, who put this company together, passed away. The only person who knew how he had the money is my mother, who's now senile. Here are her medical records. We don't have any more documentation. The case was approved. So if you get an RFE that looks like, you know, there's no way you're going to be able to get the documents to respond to it, still push back. Mm-hmm. Try to supplement it with supporting documents. But what I tend to see in consultations from other attorneys is that they'll come back and say, it's not worth it. So I don't have these documents, specific documents that USCIS requested. So we're just going to advise the client to withdraw. Don't do that. Fight it as much as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to piggyback on Anu and Jana's point, I think communication with clients is very important in this area, right? We have to explain to them what the current requirements are. This is a moving target, and there are things that you can provide, and there are things that may not be available. And ultimately, we give recommendations, but it's ultimately the client's decision how much to provide and whether to file or not.
So that goes quite nicely into our next discussion, which is on tax returns. So, Jan, I'm going to turn to you on kind of giving us the background of whether or not tax returns are mandatory and what you see in your practice.
Yeah, that's like a loaded question. What we see a lot of times, and it really does depend on the country that the investor comes from and their tax how their taxes are governed in those countries. What we see is if obviously, I love tax returns. If I can get a tax return or financial statement that's going to tie in and reconcile to the income earned from a business operation, from an individual aspect, a lot of countries, they may have the business returns that are impeccable, where maybe an individual taxation is a little bit lax, for a better term. So what you would focus on is trying to focus on the business side and seeing if the investor can have some sort of distribution or salary documentation from the business. Obviously, if the country does not have a sophisticated tax system, or if it's not governed very well, and so tax returns sometimes are not reflective of the true income, or they're just not filed, it's very difficult to obviously include those into a report. So what I would try to do is obviously have some sort of alternative documentation. Letters from employer, letters from showing bank accounts, showing the deposits of their salary coming in, something that would substantiate their income in a different way. And I would not have those tax returns, obviously, if they did not support the fact pattern of the true cash flow. We haven't had any RFEs come back to question that, because we do try to always have an alternative substantiation. And what I have found in a lot of countries, the business returns will hold a lot of weight and are very accurate and true to their financials, tying into their financials. And if I'm in a situation where there are no tax returns, I do rely on financial statements or a financial advisor, a letter from their you know, personal advisor or attorney, if that's all I can get. So again, I've always been able to find some sort of documentation, and third-party representation is key. Having it come not from the individual investor, but a third-party advisor, attorney, or professional in some capacity. We've had clients go back, investors go back, and produce financial statements. They may have their internal books and records. We've asked them to go produce proper and financial statements under the letterhead of their accountant so that we could include those in the report.
So what if your investor was here in the United States, let's say on an H-1B or an F-1 OPT, how would you advise them on the necessity of tax returns for their source of funds?
Right. If you're talking about someone who is in the U.S. and is residing here, has employment here, making money, investments here, or business here, their returns have to be filed and they have to be accurate. There's not a question of that. If it's something as far as, I'm actually not an attorney, I'm a CPA. I that's what I do. I do taxes, but we also supplement. We work with immigration attorneys to work on the source of funds and the tracing. So what we do is we recommend, we'll help them with their tax filing. We review their tax filings. Especially if there's a gift from a family member or they're making a gift, we will guide them and advise them they need to file a gift tax return or an affidavit, at least to have that as a supplemental amount. Filing a U.S. petition with incorrect U.S. returns is not something that we would want to file. Mm-hmm.
And another important thing when we're dealing with individuals in the U.S. and using their U.S. earned income is to verify and make sure that the income was earned while they have a valid work authorization in the U.S.
No, yeah, that's a great point, especially because, you know, the demographics of who the EB-5 investor is definitely changing, not just from China to India and Vietnam, but also, as you saw from Charlie's presentation, the orange bar was getting larger. So a significant chunk of EB-5 investors are now located within the U.S. So, June, I'm going to turn to you for the next question, which is regarding mortgage registration. These are scenarios where an investor in China is purchased a property and is now using that property as collateral to obtain a loan. Previously, this was considered one of the easiest and most well-documented source of funds, but now the government is coming back and asking about mortgage registrations.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not a banking or a real estate expert, and we personally have not seen a specific request for evidence for mortgage registration. But as Anu said, that there's a new trend of the USCIS requesting a proof of mortgage registration when the investor has used a piece of personal real property to secure a mortgage loan from, say, a bank. And in China, my understanding is that when you obtain a mortgage loan using a piece of real property, you are required by law to register that mortgage with the government entity that is in charge of property ownership registration. So after you sign the mortgage agreement with the bank and before the bank can actually release the loan to you, to the investor, I should say, the investor has to complete this mortgage registration process with the government. My understanding is that the registration is done and it's put into a government database that can be verified. What I've seen is that on the title document, you know, this little booklet that Chinese property owners have, there will be a stamp showing that there is a mortgage on the property, what the date when the mortgage was entered, who is the bank that the mortgage was given, getting from. And also, there are two other things that are required to register in terms of mortgage, whether there's a cancellation of the mortgage or there's a change to the mortgage. So you would see all these informations on their title document when someone has a valid and legally effective mortgage on their property. So before this RFE for proof of mortgage registration came out, typically when we document the source of fund that based on mortgage loan, we would provide, you know, purchase agreement from when the investor bought the property that shows when they bought it, for how much they bought it, how they paid for it. And we source that capital that was used to purchase the property. And then you include an appraisal of the current value of the property, and then you have a copy of the executed loan agreement and mortgage agreement and bank records showing that a bank has released the fund to the investor. And now it seems that the Immigration Service is picking up on this legal requirement of mortgage registration. And my guess is that the Immigration Service is asking for this document because they're challenging the legality or the validity of the mortgage loan. And there are a couple of issues that I can see coming out of this, right? If you have a client who obtained loan and mortgage agreement but never actually registered it with the government, then when this RFV comes out, you would not be able to provide proof of the mortgage. And by that time, it could be a year or two after they initially obtained the loan, and they could have already paid off the loan, and the mortgage itself and the cancellation of mortgage would not have been registered, which would not be a good situation to deal with. And it's one issue if the USCIS take the stand that your source of fund is not lawful because the loan was not valid. It's another and more serious problem if the USCIS finds the investor for providing fraudulent documents. And it, obviously, this is speculative. I have not dealt with this situation. And I don't know personally whether all loans, mortgage loans, have to be registered with the government. So possibly we can obtain a letter from a lawyer in China who can attest to the facts that the registration is not required, or if there's alternative proof to show that the loan was legally obtained and valid under Chinese law.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would do. We just received our first RFE asking for mortgage registration last week. So, of course, we have no idea how we're going to respond to it quite yet, but one of the suggestions was, you know, first we asked the client if it was registered. We're still waiting to hear back from that. And if it wasn't, you know, you can ask other attorneys in China to opine on this, maybe get a letter from the bank confirming that it's not a mandatory registration requirement. There's going to be a lot of ways that you can argue this. And of course, the last stance is going to be if the bank was willing to give a loan and they thought this was perfected, you can't now arbitrarily start enforcing bank laws overseas. And that's the argument that we're potentially going to have to make. Now, this is for investors who already have their 526 petitions pending. So for investors who don't have it pending, you definitely want to advise them up front, hey, this is what USCIS is asking for. And I think the trend is going to be not so much for investors from other countries that are getting their loan from a financial institution. I think it's more likely when they're taking out private loans. So if an investor's property is only worth the equivalent of $550,000 or $560,000, they're not going to be able to go to a bank and get 100% of their equity in term for a loan. So they're more likely to take out a private loan from an individual or a company that they know. And I think the trend that we're going to see is USCIS is going to come back and question those a lot more. And so if you're dealing with any private loans, you definitely want to make sure that that lien against that property is registered with a local housing authority. So I'm going to turn to both of you for this one, which is inconsistencies with prior visa applications. And we, we're focusing on China, but this is, of course, going to be, as you've seen from the other categories, it applies to every single EB-5 investors. So can you guys give me a little bit of background of what USCIS could potentially do and what, if anything, you guys are seeing in your practice?
I think as part of preparing a new source of funds, when you always need to go and ask the questions and review what has been submitted for any prior visas or any EB-5 prior applications or any type of anything that's been submitted to the government, because you don't want to present something in a source of funds report that is contrary to their fact pattern. If they are here in the United States under a a business investment visa, and there was a source of funds presented at that point in time. You don't want to come in and do anything that's contrary to that or question that in any way. So you do need to review it and be cognizant of it. It's not going to maybe the source of fund is from a different path than a prior investment, but it's something that you do need to be aware of, and you just the part of the review process is going to be reviewing both sides to question that, and that's something that you just have to be very careful of. I haven't had that issue where it's been inconsistent. We've just had to be very careful. If they did come into the country, they said, my investment into this business was this fact pattern, and now I'm taking a dividend or salary from that business, I am sourcing that same fact pattern, but in much greater detail for the EB-5 versus the visa they were on currently. So I do need to just make sure that, you know, all my facts are in line and it ties into what they presented. And if it doesn't, for whatever reason, I do try to maybe find another source or something else that, mm-hmm. that I can work with.
Yeah, I agree with Jenna. And I think this issue not only happens in the EB-5 context, and we are seeing more and more scrutiny from the Immigration Service and also at consulate level, where the government is looking back in previous visa applications, immigration petitions, or non-immigrant petitions to look for inconsistencies. And it's important. So for investors, a lot of times, if they don't speak English, and we often see this in China because of the, you know, the prevalence of visa agents helping people or working for people to get visas, a lot of times their DS-160s are not filled out by the applicant. And a lot of times applicants have no idea what was put into those DS-160s. They don't even have the login information for their account with the consulate. So when that kind of things happens, and in the source of fund context, if you are sourcing their funds based on their employment income, you have to try the best to make sure that their employment history that's presented in the source of fund is consistent with their employment history filled out in their DS-160. And in a broader context, when outside of source of funds, we also want to make sure that we understand fully our client's previous encounters with the U.S. immigration and consulates, right? Because not only their I-526 is under heavy scrutiny, but also when they're going to the visa interview at the IV stage or when they're filing their adjustment of status, we sure know that the Immigration Service and the consulates are looking closely at all the documentations that they're providing. And we also know that DS-260s and adjustment, the form I-485s are getting longer and longer these days, asking for a whole lot of details. So like Diana said, I think it's very important upfront to have a full picture and understanding of our client's previous encounters with U.S. government and immigration.
So going to what both Jan and June said, yeah, it's everything is fair game at this point. So if you have mm-hmm. a B-1, B-2 application and the client didn't put a concurrent employment and that income from that concurrent employment was used for EB-5 funds, you're going to have issues. It's important to have that conversation with your client, and I think, you know, a lot of attorneys don't have that from what I'm hearing, unfortunately. You want to kind of give that upfront information. We have a 13-page questionnaire that they have to give their entire employment history. We match that up when we're doing their SPOF. They have to confirm that all of this information is accurate. And yeah, the investors get really mad because they say that our questionnaire is longer than the 526 form, but we don't want a situation where you get your 526 approved and then you get hit with inconsistencies at the consulate. Mm-hmm. So now we're turning to India, where, of course, everyone is definitely focusing a lot of their marketing efforts for, and we're seeing a rise in Indian investors. And it's a completely different beast. With China and even Vietnam to some extent, there was an infrastructure already in place, especially with agents who'd been in the industry for quite some time and who'd essentially trained the market on what documentation was needed, the expected timeline that they can for putting together this EB-5 petition. With India, we don't see that. There's kind of chaos at the ground level in India a lot of times. And so I'm going to turn to you, Jenna, and kind of talk about what it entails documenting a source of funds for an Indian investor. How do you see them kind of putting together their money? Does it tend to be one source of funds or multiple source of funds? And what's your strategy with an Indian investor?
Well, we've been pretty fortunate in some of our circumstances. We work with the Indian investors that we've worked with are they have proper tax filings. They have business financials. There is an air of financial complexity, I guess, in that market. So when we've worked with their accountants, we've been able to get that information. But it varies from actually just overall, not just India, but any investor. If they have limited funds, a lot of times you will see multiple family members and multiple avenues of having to pull from to receive their total investment. And we're down to, you know, getting $50,000 from here and $25,000 from there. And again, any report, it's a source of funds report. That's what we're doing. But you want it to be, remember, you're having someone review this. It is it's a story, it's a timeline of how these funds were sourced. So the more complex, the more detailed you are, you have to be very specific. I've prepared diagrams and flow charts of the funds to make it easier, just because you want it to be very clear. And sometimes when you do have a multiple source of funds, multiple real estate that's been, you know, refinanced, and the funds and the gifts from family members, it does make it more complex. So ideally, obviously, you would want to have very limited sourcing of funds. But in the case of some situations, a lot of situations, they are pulling from multiple sources. So as a preparer and as a reviewer of these funds and these reports, you just need to make sure that you do detail it. It's very clear. I've actually taken on some RFEs, not reports we've prepared, but helped to assist in an RFE. And sometimes the idea is that we just throw enough information and enough, you know, bullet points with all of the documents that's sufficient. And it's very hard to understand. And if we can't understand it, if the investor can't understand it, USCIS will come back and ask questions. And a lot of times there's the idea that we're going, you know, you're going to put as much information about their, you know, the investor has 25 companies, they have a lot of investment, a lot of money, and that just adds additional questions for them to come back for. If that's not where the source of funds is coming from, don't include it. Don't include their entire net worth of their network. A lot of times investors love to tell me all about how they made their money. I'm only concerned with how did you earn your EB-5 investment and your admin fee. And then we go from there, and that's all I include in the report. So it limits the amount of what they can come and ask for. They can, because they will come back and ask for a random business in the registration, which has nothing to do with the funds. So I've had a mix with my India clients. I wouldn't say that it was anything very specific. Sometimes you will have a lot of real estate transactions, a lot of high net worth individuals who have invested in stock, the stock market, which can be challenging as far as just the documentation is not as standard as it is here in the United States for their brokerage accounts. But, you know, we ask for the documents and they are able to provide all of the substantiating forms. So it's not a matter of them not having those forms available. It's just asking and getting that information and requesting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just throw in a little more background for the people who are newer to source of funds. Like Jana said, it's not, it may, you know, ask for more scrutiny from the USCIS, the more sources that you're using. But at the same time, if that's all the investor or the client has to work with, then it's not necessarily, it's not necessary to just shy away from taking that case either. And for Indian investors, not Indian investors, I think this is a case where it kind of applies across the board. Mm-hmm. When you have multiple sources, the law only requires us to source the $500,000 capital investment plus the administrative fee pursuant to the IPO. And it's not enough to say, oh, this investor makes $550,000 a year for the past 10 years, and here's $500,000 for his investment. You actually have to link that $500,000 to his bank account and explain all the significant deposits into that bank account, right? So it could be that the investor has made $50,000 a year for the past 5 years, then he put his savings into like a fixed term savings account, which is very common in India, and they could have put it in the stock market, they could have purchased a piece of property with it and made rental incomes. So you will have to sort through all of those incomes that that constituted the cash in the end that the investor uses towards the investment. And it's very important to be, you know, very detail-oriented and cover every single step of the way.
So I'll just give you kind of a little bit of a practice pointer from specifically my Indian investors, because with the Chinese investors, if they went through an agent, there was an expected turnaround time of a couple of weeks from the time you got the source of funds documents until the case was filed, because the agents did most of the legwork. Unfortunately, that timeline has, or that the expectation of that timeline has persevered when there's not too much kind of help from agents to put together the Indian documentation. So, I mean, we've had a case where we had 25 different properties for one source of funds, and they needed all 25 properties to just get to the $500,000. And they said, okay, we're retaining you today. You can file in 2 weeks, right? And I'll give you all of the documentation the day before I'm expecting to file it. You're going to have that very uncomfortable conversation at the beginning of what that expected timeline is going to look like will vary depending on how many sources of funds you have, how multi-layered that source of funds is going to be. And one kind of other quick point is with my Indian investors, I see a lot of HUFs. You know, there's a huge family unit that is depositing money into basically what you can call the equivalent of a trust in the US. And there's a Kartha, who's the head of the HUF, who can kind of determine where all of that money is going to. Most of the time, you're going to see that your EB-5 investor is the Kartha, so they can use the money. You still want to document the money that's going in and prove that that money is coming actually from him. If there's a commingling of funds and he hasn't at least put in $500,000 into that HUF, you definitely want to start documenting some of the other deposits that will end up leading to the $500,000 that he's planning on withdrawing.
And would you treat those additional funds, if they came from another family member, they would have to have a gift?
Ideally, I would like to. I mean, it's technically considered a trust, and the Kartha has full control over all of the money. But in order not to get that RFE, I don't think it's a bad idea to maybe get a letter from a chartered accountant in India explaining what that is, and potentially even just having a gift agreement to bypass even just getting that RFE done. The other point is solo proprietorships. You're going to see this quite a lot in India. Unlike the US, it's not considered a separate entity. So you'll have cases where the investor will have one bank account that's their personal account and the solo proprietorships account. So you have deposits coming in from the business, and so you'll need to get a letter from a chartered accountant explaining how much of that money is coming from the business and the fact that the investor can use it at their discretion and it's considered their money.
And I had a case like that where we did have to have them go back, because you can't present a bank account with the commingle, you know, with it's very unclear about what's a business, what was part of the business and what was personal. So they were able to go to their CA and then go get a financial statement, a standard financial statement to state, here's the income, here's the expenses, and we presented it that way, and it went through. So.
Yeah, so, and Jenna was previously mentioning that you're going to see kind of multiple sources of funds now, and part of what we're seeing is multiple gifts from either, it used to be close family members, but now we're seeing employers gifting money, we are seeing distant relatives, and maybe even family friends starting to gift money. So June, can you tell me a little about how comfortable you are in taking on cases where the investor's being gifted their investment funds from non-family members, and what type of documents you would expect to see?
Yeah, so for under the rules, there's no limitation on whether the gift has to come from a family member or a friend or an unrelated person. But obviously, when you have a gift situation, you not only have to document that gift, but also have to provide sufficient proof of the source of fund of the gift tour. So when we have clients who come to, or interested clients who come to us to say, oh, I have this friend who has this amount of money sitting around, can I just get a gift from them? Usually we have a conversation about, can your friend document his source of fund and how did he get all that money sitting around, and is he or she willing to disclose all his or her financial documentation to us and to the Immigration Service? And most of the time that line of thinking just stops there. Theoretically, right? For a gift from a non-family member, I think you need to document. You have a deed of gift or a gift. I think some people use gift affidavits. That's signed by both parties, by the giftor and the giftee, and you make sure that it is both parties are fully understanding the terms of the deed or the affidavit, and it's a binding document that that shows that the money is truly a gift and there's no expectation of repayment. And then you have to provide all the source of fund from the giftor. Mm-hmm. And then obviously also document the trace of the fund from the giftor to the giftee. And one thing that's very important in a gift situation is that the investor has to have control and possession of the capital before the capital is made wire transferred to the project.
So we actually had never seen this before, but we heard of a case where the giftor was in the United States and the government actually came back and said, prove to me that you actually declared this gift on your tax returns. You, U.S. citizen giftor, declared this on your tax returns. So you want to, again, it's uncomfortable conversations at the beginning that you want to have with your investor and make sure that the giftor is willing to provide a lot of detailed financial documents up front. And as June said, you know, we find that at least half of them kind of step back and go, okay, maybe this person is not the best giftor. We'll try to find someone else who is willing to provide it, because you don't want to find out 18 months from now that they're not willing to provide documentation. Right. And so this actually is, this next topic is something that is new to me, and it's something that I think was new to some of the people in the panel, which is what a rent deposit in Korea, and whether or not that money can actually be used as a legitimate source of funds, and what level and type of documentation you would need if you wanted to use that deposit as your source of funds. So June, I think you were able to kind of get some background information on that.
I had to dig back at all the South Korean applications we've done. I did find one where we used a rent deposit. So what my understanding is, a rent deposit is where it's a very common practice in South Korea when someone has a piece of real property that they rent out. And instead of receiving rental payments month by month, they receive a lump sum payment they call a rent deposit that equals the total rental income for the entire rental period. So if you're renting out a piece of property for a year or 2 years, that could be a significant amount of money. And what we have used to document that particular case is we were able to find an ownership document from showing that the investor owns the piece of property. We have very a legally binding, you know, leasing agreement clearly explaining what's the rental period, what's the rent deposit arrangement, and we also have bank statements corresponding to the arrangement, that's a payment arrangement that was laid out in the leasing agreement.
So the next question I'm going to turn to Jana, which is the American Institute in Taiwan's review of EB-5 source of funds. And this is something that our panel discussed at length for across multiple days, and we couldn't kind of determine if Taiwan was doing something different than what we're seeing in other kind of countries. So before I start, I'm going to give a shout out right here to David Enderline. And this is one of the things I must say that I love about AILA and I love about the EB-5 industry is that if you're not 100% sure, because we do mass volumes of China, Korea, Brazil, and India, but I've done 3 Taiwanese cases, all of them adjusted status in the U.S., so never dealt with the Taiwan kind of this issue, walked up to David and said, give me information, right? So, and that's one of the things that I love that you can do in this industry. But Jenna, if I can turn to you and kind of give a little bit background on what's happening and what you're seeing kind of across the board in just all jurisdictions at this point.
Because what we're seeing is that a lot of the jurisdictions, even though the report has been finalized, there may be some review at those stages that are coming back, and I guess especially in Taiwan, where they are doing these secondary reviews and questioning, looking at the full source of funds. This is not a USCIS issue. This is the jurisdictional area. And I haven't seen that much of a kickback, but they are questioning the actual investors at certain points, where they're questioning are the fact patterns that they've presented in their applications and their source of funds. So that's something that we've seen. It's pretty new, pretty interesting as far as that we're concerned, but it's also something that you want to make sure that what you're presenting is accurate, is defendable, and that the investor, if you are working with an agent, that it is coming from the investor and their personal information.
Yeah, so what David mentioned was being seen in Taiwan is that before the interview, they are asking for the full source of funds petition as if they know already ahead of time that they're planning on re-adjudicating this SPOF at the consulate, which they don't have jurisdiction to do. So the other jurisdictions, especially in India, we just started seeing it, where at least they're pretending, they're forcing the investor to go to the interview, and then they issue a letter saying, hey, give me your SPOF documents. In Taiwan, you're seeing they're asking for it up front, so you know ahead of time that they're planning on re-adjudicating the SPOF at that stage.
Yeah, I agree. And we have very recently had one case in India, in Mumbai, actually, where our investor attended the interview, immigrant visa interview, and first, he was asked a whole lot of questions about how he picked the project, details about the project, which we haven't seen. The level of scrutiny was not known to us from previous cases. And then he got a request for evidence asking, among other things, that he legally opened a U.S. account that was used to transfer his investment capital to the project. And so that tells us that at the consulate level, they're not only looking at issues that's already being adjudicated by the Immigration Service, but they're also coming up with new questions that, I almost wanted to just get back to the consulate and say, this is none of your business, but obviously we can't jeopardize our clients' chance of getting an immigrant visa.
And that's kind of the running theme that even the attorneys that I've kind of spoken to at the seminar has just been, where do we draw the line in the sand? Mm-hmm. We, as attorneys, would love to litigate this like crazy, and it's up to the investor, right? We say, we can litigate it. It may take us a little while. It may take you some extra money, or even if we just want to litigate it and we're willing to do it for very cheap or for no money, the investor's going to say, why? I have the documents, so let's just provide it and get that approval. And so it's unfortunate, but we are definitely seeing the line kind of being moved up. And I don't blame the investors. You have $500,000 at risk. You spent a year and a half, 2.5 years getting to this point. If you have the documents, why not just present it? So I'm waiting for the investor that doesn't have those documents, and then we can start the actual fight.
Good luck.
Yeah. We'll see if that happens. So the last kind of topic that we want to touch on is, of course, this year there was a policy that was put out that the government said that they're not going to issue RFEs. If you don't provide documentation with your initial filing, it's going to be a straight denial. Do you guys see that impacting EB-5?
Well, definitely, I think it's going, what I think the idea was is to prevent people from kind of placeholding and doing these frivolous filings to hold when they don't have the evidence. I know we've come up to a couple of extensions, and reports have been, you know, applications have been presented to at least get in before the deadline. And I think that's where this is going to come in, and there may be some just initial review, and there's a straight denial. I think this was in effect September 30th, a few weeks before that. We were supposed to see that. I have not seen anything come through, but as far as I don't think it's meant for the individual, the investor who has put forth the effort and the ability to prove their source of funds, that there's just going to be a straight denial. That's my opinion. I think it's more for the frivolous filings or the just, you know, lack of information and
Yeah, I agree with Jana. We haven't seen any real actions in the UE5 realm, or actually in any other of the filings that we've done. But definitely it makes it more important for us to not just go ahead with a bare bone petition and really put in the effort up front and provide as much documentation needed to build up a case. And I did read in some of the, I think it was a transcript from an engagement call with the USCIS, where they explained that this memo is not meant to be used to straight up deny simple errors. It is really meant to give more discretion to the adjudicators in when they encounter a bare bone petition or a frivolous filing, but how that's going to be implemented and enforced at the regional, you know, at the service center level, well, I guess we shall see.
And that's sometimes I see, you know, as far as when you have children who are going to age out and there is that timing, that's going to come into play.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So bare bones application is pretty much you file the filing fee check and the forms, and I've seen, unfortunately, attorneys do that where they just file those two forms again to get the priority date and then force USCIS to come back with just mountains of maybe 5, 6, 7 page RFEs just asking for basic documents. Mm-hmm. And I do think that this is kind of going towards that. You don't want bare bones filing. You want to try to file a complete petition. And again, just small errors if you forget one or two documents, or the government truly has a question about your source of funds, I don't expect it to be a straight denial. Mm-hmm. So I think that is actually our time, and we've been pretty good about keeping our time this time. We have maybe time for one question. I would prefer, if it's not a substantive question, those we can kind of talk about individually. Fantastic. So that means we did a spectacular job of covering all of our topics. So if you have any questions, feel free. We are all available for the next few minutes before the next panel starts. But then after that, we'll definitely ask you to listen to the next panel because they have a lot of great information as well.
Sorry, I didn't think if you saw that, but she was like flashing.
Hello. The code for this panel was 1679.